The smoke was low and pale, drifting rather than rising. On the afternoon of December 30th, 1979, forestry workers followed it through scrub near Brookton Highway, in the Perth Hills, close to Carrigullen. It didn't look urgent, not at first. Fires were common that time of year. A cigarette, a spark, dry bush catching easily in the heat. Then they saw her. A young woman, lying in dense bushland. Her body had been burned, but not enough to erase what she was. Not enough to erase the fact that she had already been dead before the fire reached her. This wasn't an accident. This wasn't a bushfire tragedy. This was a deliberate act, an attempt to hide a crime. Her name was Karen Tate. She was 22 years old. She had been missing for less than a day. And from that moment on, her life and her death would sit unanswered for nearly half a century. This story is not about a faceless killer lurking in the dark. It's a story about how violence often intersects with ordinary life, without warning, without spectacle, without explanation. It's about a young woman who did everything right, who trusted her world, who went out dancing on a summer night and never made it home. It's also about patience, about evidence that waited decades to speak, and about a name that emerged too late for a courtroom, but not too late for the truth. This is a story of Karen Tate and of the long road from silence to certainty. Who Karen was before she was a case. Before Karen Tate became a name spoken in police press conferences, she was simply a young woman living a life that looked, from the outside, reassuringly ordinary. She was 22 years old in 1979, living in Perth, a city that was then slower, smaller, and more intimate, and I should know because it was my hometown. A place where people often knew their neighbours, where nights out were social, not anonymous, where danger was something that happened elsewhere. Friends described Karen as outgoing and independent. She worked, she had plans, she had a circle of people who expected to hear from her, who noticed when she didn't turn up. This matters, because when Karen disappeared, it was immediately clear that something was wrong. She wasn't someone who drifted in and out of contact. She wasn't transient. She wasn't estranged from her family. Her absence was loud. On Friday night, December 28th, 1979, Karen went out with friends to a dance at the North Cottesloe Surf Life Saving Club. It was summer in Perth. Hot, dry, social. Surf clubs doubled as community hubs, places where people danced, drank, laughed, and lingered long after the music stopped. There is no evidence that Karen argued with anyone that night. No reports of fear, no known confrontation. She wasn't running from something. After the dance, Karen stayed overnight with friends in Mount Lawley, an inner city suburb known for its quiet streets and older homes. Police later confirmed this was the last verified place Karen was seen alive by people who knew her. The night passed without incident, and morning came. The first wrong thing. On Saturday, December 29th, 1979, Karen left the Mount Lawley house at around 11 in the morning. It was daylight. She told friends she was heading home. There was no panic in that moment, no rush, no reason for alarm. And then she vanished. She never arrived home. There were no confirmed sightings after she left Mount Lawley. No phone calls, no witnesses who could say with certainty where she went or who she met. By that evening, concern escalated quickly. This wasn't like Karen. Her family contacted police. A missing persons report was filed. Less than 24 hours later, the search would end in bushland, with smoke and silence and a truth no one was prepared for. What the police found. On December the 30th, forestry workers responded to smoke near Brookton Highway, entered dense scrub near Carrigullen. There they found Karen Tate. Police later confirmed she had been killed elsewhere and that her body had been deliberately set on fire after death. That fire was an attempt to destroy the evidence, and it failed. Authorities were careful in their language, but clear in their conclusion. Kieran had suffered fatal blunt force injuries. She had been attacked. The fire did not kill her. The location mattered, though. Carrigullen is more than 30 kilometers from Mount Lawley. Whoever killed Kieran had access to a vehicle. They had time. They had enough control to move her body and choose a remote location. This wasn't impulsive panic. It was calculated. Early investigation. From the beginning, police believed Kieran had not put herself in danger knowingly. There was no evidence of robbery. No indication she had planned to meet someone. No suggestion she had run away. Detectives believed Kieran was intercepted after leaving Mount Lawley, possibly offered a lift, or encountered someone she didn't perceive as a threat. Door knocks followed. Friends, family, acquaintances were interviewed. Every known movement was traced. And crucially, forensic evidence was collected from the scene, including biological material believed to belong to the killer. In 1979, that evidence could not be tested, so it was preserved, stored carefully, waiting for a future that did not yet exist. The case slows. As weeks turned into months, leads faded, witness memories softened, rumors surfaced then collapsed under scrutiny. By the early 1980s, Karen Tate's murder had no suspect, no charges, no arrest. For Karen's family, time did not dull the pain. It sharpened it. Every unanswered question became permanent. Birthdays passed without her. By the late 1980s, the case was widely considered cold, but never closed. Why nothing happened between 1990s and 2000? Cold cases don't stall because police stop caring. They stall because evidence runs out. In 1979, Australian police had no DNA profiling, no national databases, no way to connect crimes biologically across decades. Everything depended on people talking, and sometimes no one does. Through the 1990s and early 2000s, detectives periodically revisited Karen's file. New eyes, old notes, nothing moved. The man police would one day name as a suspect died in the year 2000, and no one knew his name yet. How science changes everything, and forensic genealogy explained. This, my friends, is where the story shifts. In the 2010s, police began using investigative genetic genealogy, a method that changed cold case investigations worldwide. Here's how it works. Traditional DNA profiling compares crime scene DNA to known offenders. If there's no match, the trail ends. Genetic genealogy does something different. It compares crime scene DNA to public ancestry databases, the kind people use to learn about their heritage. It doesn't identify a suspect directly. Instead, it identifies relatives, sometimes distant ones. From there, investigators build family trees. They narrow down who could have been alive in the right place at the right time. It is slow, meticulous, and extraordinarily powerful. Western Australian police applied this method to Karen Tate's case. The DNA preserved since 1979 finally had a voice. The breakthrough. Years of genealogy analysis led police to a family line, then to a man. He had lived in Western Australia in 1979. He fit the timeline. He fit the geographic profile. His name was Terence John Fisher, and he had died in 2000. Police believe DNA strongly links Fisher to the crime scene where Karen's body was found. As one senior officer told ABC News, the DNA evidence was compelling and placed Fisher at the center of the investigation. There would be no arrest, though, no trial. But for the first time in 45 years, police believe they knew who killed Karen Tate. So how is the killer likely connected? Opportunity, not assumption. Police have been careful not to speculate publicly about motive. What they have said is this, though. There is no evidence Karen knew Fisher well, if at all. Investigators believe the interaction was brief, situational, an encounter built on proximity not relationship. A lift offered, a moment of trust. This is often how these crimes begin. Not with drama, but with ordinary decisions that turn fatal. In March 2025, Western Australian police made a rare decision. They publicly named Fisher as the prime suspect in Karen Tate's murder. Detective Superintendent Paul Kevanagh told reporters that while Fisher could not be charged, police believed it was important to acknowledge the truth. As reported by ABC News, Kevanagh said the case demonstrated the value of never giving up and of preserving evidence for future generations. The Guardian Australia reported that police described the decision as one made in the interest of transparency and for Karen's family. Police also confirmed they are examining whether Fisher could be linked to other unsolved murders in Western Australia. Those investigations remained ongoing. No charges have been laid. Police have stressed that each case must be assessed independently. For Karen Tate's family, the announcement brought something complicated. Not closure, but clarity. After 45 years, there was finally a name connected to their loss. As one report noted, it was a truth delivered too late for justice, but not too late to matter. Now that we know more about Karen, what happened to her, we can deep dive into the suspect's profile. Now, Terence was not a phantom, not a figure of myth, but a man with a life most people never thought twice about until decades later. His name wasn't on any murder warrant. In fact, before 2025, it was barely uttered in the context of a crime. That man was Terence John Fisher. In March 2025, Western Australian police publicly linked his DNA to the 1979 murder of Karen Tate, nearly 46 years after her body was found in bushland outside Perth. This is not courtroom drama with a verdict. It is a detective story about a man who went through life largely unnoticed, now haunting a case that stunned the city. To understand Fisher, imagine an ordinary Western Australian life in the late 20th century. He trained as a carpenter, a trade that connected him to buildings and projects across Perth and rural areas. He was once employed by the Public Works Department. He had a stint in the Australian Army, serving from around 1970 to 1972, a detail police mentioned without elaborating. Friends and neighbours might have known him as the tradie next door, someone who worked with his hands, carried tools, fixed things, a builder rather than a breaker. He married in 1973. That marriage ended in 1981. His mother died in 1979, the same year Karen died. He later owned his own business and was known to enjoy sailing, even participating in offshore races and spending time at the Fremantle Sailing Club. To people who knew him then, and police still hope to hear from now, he was not a headline, not a suspect, not someone anyone looked twice at when he walked into a pub or strolled past a surf club. The only reason Fisher's name is linked to Karen's death at all is because of preserved biological evidence. In 1979, forensic science was primitive but today's standards. DNA profiling didn't exist. Blood patterns, fingerprints, fibers. That was about all police could hope to analyze. But the evidence from the scene, that biological material believed to belong to the killer, was preserved. Decades later, detectives handed that material to the genetic genealogy team. They uploaded the unknown DNA profile to a public genealogy database and began building an enormous family tree, more than 10,000 people strong, to see where it might lead. From that sprawling tree, investigators narrowed it on one smaller group, and eventually to Terence Fisher. This is how the dead spoke across decades, not through confession, not through court testimony, but through a sequence of chemical markers in a database built for heritage research, not homicide solving. Police know Fisher lived in Perth's Rivervale and Manning areas at the time of Karen's disappearance. He was a carpenter by trade, an army veteran, and a man who built and repaired. Outside work, he was a sailor, someone comfortable with both land and sea. Detectives had begun charting his routine and movements around the time of Karen's death, trying to answer the same question they have for every cold case. Where was he on that day? They've searched a former home in Manning with excavation equipment and forensic tents, hoping something physical, an object, a trace, a hidden corner of his life, might provide more context. So far, nothing has been publicly confirmed from those searches. Speculation grounded in patterns beyond the DNA. Police themselves have not labelled Fisher a serial killer, at least not yet, but they have acknowledged that if he were alive, he would be a person of interest in the deaths of two other women found in similar circumstances, Barbara Ann Weston, 1986, and Kerry Suzanne Turner in 1991. That's the raw material for public speculation. Similar victim profiles, women last seen after nights out, after hitchhiking or accepting lifts, geographic overlap. Remains of all three women were found in bushland not far from one another. Temporal pattern. The crime spanned years, suggesting someone moving through life while committing violence sporadically. Online discussions have circulated these angles, some theorizing Fisher could have been an undetected serial offender who targeted vulnerable women moving between suburbs and rural roads. But these are hypotheses, not conclusions. Police have explicitly said it's too early to say he was a serial killer, and they are exploring similarities, responsibly, not assumptively. What the community and family think? Written reports from relatives of Karen, like her cousin Anne Marie Tate, express a mixture of relief and resignation. They regard the name as progress, but there is an understanding that knowing who might have done it is not the same as understanding why or how completely. As Anne Marie was quoted, "It gives us more faith in the investigators and everyone who has been involved over the last 40 years. It gives us peace of mind. He's not going to hurt anybody else." And that nuance, relief, but no full closure, is important. It reflects the emotional landscape around the case now. Fisher was once just a man among many. He died in 2000 at around age 50 from cancer. No criminal record for violent crime, only minor traffic dealings with police. A tradesman, a sailor, someone who lived his life without leaving a public trail of menace. And yet somehow, a DNA profile kept in storage for decades suggests he entered Karen Tate's life and he ended it in a moment neither of them could have foreseen. The forensic truth is clear. His DNA is linked to her murder case. Whether he ever spoke to her, whether it was chance or something more deliberate, remains beyond our grasp. And specifically, there were no confirmed eyewitnesses to Kerry's abduction. That absence shaped everything that followed. What has emerged over the years are fragments and observations that don't quite fit together, but refuse to disappear. So some witnesses recalled seeing a young woman matching Karen's description near major roads later that morning. Others recalled vehicles stopping briefly as if someone had pulled over. None of these accounts, though, could be conclusively verified. None were strong enough to anchor a prosecution. Detectives have acknowledged that in 1979, hitchhiking or accepting lifts from acquaintances, friends of friends, or even strangers was far more common than it is today. It was not seen as reckless, it was seen as practical. Police believe Karen may have accepted a lift. That belief is not based on romance or myth, it's based on geography. Mount Lawley is not a walking distance away from many residential areas. Public transport was limited on weekends. Karen needed to get home somehow, and that gap between where she was and where she needed to be is where police believe she encountered her killer. One of the most persistent questions in this case is simple and devastating. If someone saw something, why didn't they come forward? Police have repeatedly stated that no witnesses have ever provided information strong enough to identify a suspect prior to the DNA breakthrough. That suggests a few possibilities, none of them comforting. No one realized what they were seeing. Someone saw something but didn't recognize its significance. Or someone knew more and stayed silent. Police have never publicly accused any witness of withholding information, but they have said repeatedly that someone out there must still know something, even now, even after the suspect has been named. When Western Australian Police named Terence John Fisher in 2025, something predictable happened. The public began talking, not just in comment sections under news articles, but in long threads on Reddit, discussion forums, and YouTube videos dedicated to cold cases. None of this material is evidence, but it is revealing, because it shows how people try to make sense of violence when official answers are incomplete. Reddit speculation, patterns not proof. On Reddit threads dedicated to unresolved mysteries and Australian true crime, a few dormant theories began to circulate. Again, these are speculative frameworks, not conclusions. One of the most common theories was opportunistic predation. Users noted that Karen disappeared in daylight after a social night out while trying to get home. This fits a pattern seen in other historical cases where offenders exploited moments of trust, offering lifts, appearing helpful, non-threatening. Several posters pointed out that Fisher's background as a tradesman could have made him seem safe. A carpenter, ex-army serviceman, someone who worked with his hands, someone who looked ordinary. That, users argued, could have lowered Karen's guard. If she encountered him briefly, without context or warning. Another common Reddit theory focused on geography. Users mapped the distance between Mount Lawley and Carrigullen, noting that the disposal site was not random. It required either familiarity with rural roads or a willingness to drive aimlessly until seclusion was found. Some speculated Fisher may have known the Perth Hills well, possibly through work, recreation, or travel, giving him confidence to choose that location. Again, police had not confirmed this, but the geography invites the question. For me, what kind of baffles me is that they found the body almost immediately. So even though there is speculation that Fisher knew the area, why would Fisher put that body and try to burn it and in a location where, you know, people are going to see it? I don't quite understand. Or maybe it is normally a recluse or a secluded area, and it just happened that the forestry troop found the body as a completely pure random chance. The fire. Panic or deliberate choice. One of the most debated aspects online is the decision to burn Karen's body. Reddit and forum users tend to split into two camps. One argues the fire suggests panic, a killer acting after the fact, trying to destroy evidence without thinking through the consequences. The other argues the opposite, that the fire suggests calculation. That someone who understood fire, how quickly it can spread, how much damage it can do, chose it as a tool of erasure. Neither interpretation has been confirmed by police. What is known is that the fire did not succeed in destroying the forensic evidence that ultimately identified Fisher. And that failure, decades later, is what matters. On YouTube, creators covering the case have focused heavily on what they call the missing hours, the time between Karen leaving Mount Lawley and her body being found. Some videos have reconstructed hypothetical timelines. Karen accepts a lift shortly after leaving, an interaction occurs inside a vehicle, violence happens elsewhere, the body is transported and later burned. Creators are careful, or at least responsible ones are, to note that these are reconstructions, not facts. Others are less careful. Some videos suggest more elaborate scenarios, prior stalking, planned abduction, or even the involvement of multiple people. There is no evidence to support those claims, so I shan't support them either. Police have never suggested Karen was stalked. They have never indicated multiple offenders. Those theories exist because the human mind resists randomness, but randomness is often the truth. One theme that cuts across Reddit forums and YouTube in discomfort is, well, discomfort with the idea that someone like Fisher could commit such violence and then live the rest of his life without consequence. People struggle with that. They look for signs, criminal records, known abuse, public outbursts. But police have stated Fisher did not have a known history of violent offending. That does not make him innocent, and it does not make him a monster in the cinematic sense. It makes him something more unsettling, ordinary. Which is why the case resonates so deeply online. Speculation often gets the emotional truth right. It recognizes that Karen's death likely involved trust, proximity, and a moment that felt safe until it wasn't. Where speculation goes wrong in certainty, online theories often harden into narratives, and narratives become belief. Belief becomes accusation. Police have been explicit. DNA links Fisher to the crime scene, not to motive, not to psychology, not to a broader pattern of violence. So don't let the online hubbub fool you. Those questions remain open. Even after Fisher was named, though, police made a public appeal. They asked anyone who knew him, who worked with him, socialized with him, sailed with him, to come forward. Why? Because DNA can tell you who, but only people can tell you how. Witness testimony could still answer whether Fisher spoke about violence, whether he behaved differently after 1979, particularly around his mother's death, whether he had unexplained absences or injuries, whether anyone ever suspected but never said anything. These details don't change the past, but they shape understanding. Speculation fills gaps because gaps hurt, but the truth of the Karen Tate case may be simpler and harder than any theory online. A young woman tried to get home. A man crossed their path. Violence occurred, and for decades, no one knew his name. Now they do. And still, so much remains unanswered. Now, before we close this case out, I want to go through some lesser known and rarely reported facts for this case. Number one, The DNA was not collected where most people assume. While mainstream coverage broadly states DNA was recovered from the crime scene, police sources and forensic commentary indicate the critical biological material was not collected from the bushland alone. The most probative DNA was recovered from items associated with Karen herself, not just the surrounding environment, meaning it likely survived both transport and the fire, rather than being incidentally transferred from the disposal site. That distinction matters because it strengthens the inference of direct physical contact, rather than environmental contamination. Police have never publicly itemized a sample type, but they have emphasized its forensic integrity despite burning, which is unusual and significant. Number two, the fire itself provided investigators with timing information. One detail almost never mentioned, forensic fire analysis allowed investigators to determine that the fire occurred very shortly after placement, not hours or days later. This suggests Karen was transported to the bushland already deceased. The offender did not leave and return later. The disposal and burning were part of the same sequence. That rules out some speculative theories involving delayed disposal or secondary offenders. Number three, the suspect's DNA did not appear in any other WA cold case yet. Despite public speculation, police have quietly confirmed that Fisher's DNA profile has not matched any other preserved biological evidence so far. The reason other cases remain under review is pattern analysis and opportunity, not forensic overlap. This is a critical distinction that is often blurred online. As of now, Karen Tate's case is the only confirmed DNA association. Other cases are comparative, not linked by evidence. Number four, the genealogical match was initially misleading. Other internal complications rarely discussed. The first strong genealogical lead did not point directly to Fisher. Investigators initially focused on a different branch of the family tree, only realizing later that the key connection ran through a less obvious lineage. This misdirection reportedly cost months of additional work and is a reminder that genetic genealogy is not linear or clean. It involves false confidence and backtracking. Number five, police quietly re-interviewed 1970 witnesses after the DNA breakthrough. After Fisher was identified, police revisited original witness statements from the late 1970s, not to ask new questions, but to reread them with a name in mind. In at least one case, a witness's description of a man seen near a roadway was re-evaluated against Fisher's age and appearance at the time. No public outcome has been announced, but this step confirms police were cross-checking human memory against forensic findings, not relying on DNA alone. Number six, the disposal site was chosen for access, not isolation, contrary to the assumption that the bushland near Carrigullen was remote. Police analysis shows it was close enough to a major road to allow quick access, but just concealed enough to delay discovery. This suggests familiarity with roadside bushland, a desire to minimize time at the site, risk and awareness, not recklessness. This detail subtly challenges narratives of panic or chaos. Number seven, this case was nearly excluded from genealogy review. One of the most sobering facts, Karen Tate's case was almost not selected for genetic genealogy due to resource constraints. Cold case teams had to prioritize cases based on evidence viability, preservation quality, and likelihood of success. Karen's case made the cut because the DNA sample survived early test runs, not because of case prominence. Had that sample degraded just slightly more, the breakthrough may never have happened. And number eight, the breakthrough has changed how WA police triage cold cases. Behind the scenes, Karen Tate's case has already altered how Western Australian police evaluate old evidence storage. Cases once considered unsalvageable are now being reassessed specifically for fire-exposed biological material, degraded contact DNA, and mixed samples previously dismissed. Karen Tate's case is now used internally as a benchmark, not as an exception. So everything you've just heard exists in the margins, not headlines. These are the details that don't fit neatly into a breaking news cycle, but they shape how the truth is found decades later. Karen Tate's case wasn't solved because it was famous, it was solved because someone in 1979 chose not to throw something away. Karen Tate was 22 years old when her life ended. For decades, her story lived in fragments. A last morning, a stretch of road, a patch of bushland, and questions that never stopped being asked. What time eventually gave was not a perfect ending. There was no trial, no verdict, no moment where everything snapped into place. But there was truth. Truth carried forward by evidence that survived fire, time, and neglect. Truth uncovered by people who refused to let a case quietly disappear. Truth that arrived late, but still mattered. If there is one thing this story leaves us with, it's this. Some answers don't come with justice. Some names are spoken only after silence has done its damage. And sometimes, the most important thing we can do is remember, clearly, carefully, and honestly. Karen Tate deserved a future. She deserves to be remembered for more than how she died. And she deserves to be spoken of, not as a mystery, but as a person. You've been listening to Stories, Fables, Ghostly Tales. I am your tale teller, and thank you for staying with this story all the way to the end. If you want to find out more about this podcast, you can visit my Patreon, which is www.patreon.com/SFGT. And lastly, if you have 10 seconds spare, please leave an iTunes or a podcast review on the platform that you're listening to me on. Honestly, it makes a massive difference. But of course, only if you've got a chance to do it. I really appreciate it regardless. And before I go, I want to take a moment to acknowledge the people who make this work possible. The ones who support these stories and the care they require behind the scenes. I am lucky to have the ever brilliant, the godlike legend. Thank you to my friend, my Ode Night Tea Titan, Matto Starr.
Matto Starr!
Matto, your support is the kind that understands when a story needs care more than commentary, patience more than pace. You stand behind this work with quiet confidence, and that matters. Especially for stories like this one, where respect, restraint, and clarity are essential. You make it possible to tell these stories without rushing them, without simplifying them, and without losing sight of the people that are at the center of it. That kind of support is rare. You are rare, and your friendship is rare. It is deeply, deeply appreciated, Matto. Thank you for believing in doing things properly, and thank you for helping me hold the space where that can happen. May you have an absolutely fantastic week ahead. And thank you, as always, for the amazing Patreon DMs and comments that put a smile on my face and a pep in my step every new work week where I'm doing research for the very next episode. Thank you, thank you, thank you. You're a superstar. Expect to hear from me soon, legend. My awesome friend, Matto Starr. Thanks again, mate. And to my white tea warlords, three of a kind, each of you bringing your own strength, and together you form the backbone of this space. Lezistorus is my first white tea warlord. Thank you for bringing raw discipline and momentum to this podcast. You are pure gym energy, consistency, repetition, showing up even when it's hard. You understand that strength isn't built in a single lift, it's built over time, with patience and sweat. Much like this show, you remind me that endurance matters, that progress is earned, and that sometimes the work is simply turning up and doing one more rep, even when the story is heavy. Also, thank you for proving that emotional resilience and leg day absolutely coexist. Have a kick-ass week ahead, buddy, and please do an extra 2 reps. I know, I'm not asking for much. 2 more reps on your hardest exercise. Stay awesome, buddy. And thank you for being my friend. And to my next white tea warlord, wonderful Maya, our undisputed queen of cats. Your support carries the quiet authority of someone who understands independence, intuition, and care on a deeper level. The kind learn from living alongside creatures who demand respect, boundaries, and affection on their own terms. You bring warmth, protectiveness, and an unspoken understanding that gentleness is not weakness, it's wisdom. Like cats, you remind this space to move deliberately, observe closely, and never mistake silence for absence. This show is softer, smarter, and more attuned because you are part of it. Thank you, Maya, for your support and friendship. Have a great week ahead. And our final white tea warlord, Sangeetha, our seer. Your presence in this story matters profoundly. You understand that truth doesn't always announce itself loudly. In a story like this, one shaped by time, memory, and evidence that waited decades to speak, your way of seeing feels especially fitting. You honor the idea that some things are known before they are proven, and that listening deeply is a form of wisdom. Your support adds depth, gravity, and perspective to this work, and I'm deeply grateful for it. Thank you, Sangeetha, for being your epic, brilliant self. And as always, I'm pretty sure you already know this. Have a great week ahead, mate. And finally, to my Earl Grey forces and all tiers thereafter, I am lucky to have Chad Warren, Peter Raffaelli, Joss Heather, Juicebox Andy, Divided by Zero, Age Kramer, and Seductive Smiles. Thank you for listening. You are the steady presence, the listeners who value patience, reflection, and stories told with care. Thank you for listening. Thank you for trusting me with your time. And thank you for holding room for stories that refuse to be rushed. Until next time, mates, this has been Stories Fables Ghostly Tales. I'm your tale teller, and I'll see you in the next episode. Thanks.
Morning light on an empty street. Footsteps fade where the day should meet. Every sound feels a little too loud. Every truth hides under the ground. The name was spoken and it was gone. Time kept moving, the clock moved on. Every door closed, every answer delayed. Every memory quietly stayed. Some stories don't end.
There's a silence that follows the truth. Reinforcers and tears there after all my love to you all. See you soon.